Dr. Hilary Babcock. Dr. Babcock is an assistant professor of medicine at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. She's the medical director of Infection Prevention and Epidemiology Consortium at the BJC Healthcare and medical director of Occupational Health Infectious Disease for Barnes Jewish and St. Louis Children's Hospitals. She's also on the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America, representing that group on the National Vaccine Advisory Committee, or NVAC, healthcare personnel, influenza of vaccine and working on revising the infection prevention of healthcare personnel guidelines.
Thank you. I also have nothing to disclose. What I'm going to do today is give a little overview of our work on the National Vaccine Advisory Committee's Healthcare Personnel Influenza Vaccination Subgroup, and tell you a little bit about the discussions that have been ongoing in that group, and share our very early, very preliminary draft recommendations. So the National Vaccine Advisory Committee advises and makes recommendations to the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Health on matters related to national vaccine program responsibilities. It's a subgroup of the National Vaccine Program Office, and it's all under the broad heading of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And about a year ago, NVAC commissioned a healthcare personnel influenza vaccination subgroup. And the charge, the charge from NVAC to the subgroup was to develop recommendations on strategies to achieve the Healthy People 2020 annual goal of 90% influenza vaccine coverage for healthcare personnel. The group has a very broad membership. The co-chairs are both physicians who are based in health departments. There are three NVAC members, representatives from the Department of Health and Human Services, including the deputy director of the National Vaccine Program Office, representation from several other areas in the government, the Department of Defense, Indian Health Service, NIOSH, OSHA, the VA, and the CDC. And then there are liaison representatives from multiple organizations across the country, several medical organizations, including pediatrics, OBGYN, occupational and environmental medicine, healthcare epidemiology, healthcare settings, homes and services for the aging, American Healthcare Association, the American Hospital Association, healthcare worker-focused groups such as the Service Employees International Union, the American Nurses Association, and again, the organizations representing physicians. There's representation from the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices and from a couple of people, including Professor Stewart here on the panel, on public health policy, law, and bioethics. So the first thing that the group did was to define some areas where we felt like we needed some more education, and we asked for and received presentations in multiple areas around this question. So several presentations on epidemiology of influenza in healthcare settings, ethics around other strategies and around mandatory vaccination policies, legal issues and the model law that Professor Stewart talked about, an overall understanding of how occupational vaccine programs are managed. We heard about influenza vaccination experiences from other hospitals, St. Jude's Children's Hospital, which also has a very successful voluntary program. And then also from the CDC about their work in developing an influenza vaccination coverage method and a measure that can be used to monitor those results. And then also a presentation on new influenza vaccine technologies on the horizon. So what I'm going to do is give a little background about sort of the rationale for the recommendation about healthcare personnel vaccination, and then talk a little bit about the data that exists and how that data either supports or how that data supports the logic, and also some of the limitations of the data that we have, and then go through some points of agreement and disagreement within our group, and then share the draft with you. So the logic rationale, you know, goes like this. Influenza is infectious, and we know that person-to-person transmission can occur, and that can occur in healthcare settings as it can anywhere else. Influenza vaccination decreases the risk of getting influenza. It's not, as our previous speaker was saying, it's not a 100% guarantee that you will not get influenza, but overall it does decrease the risk of getting influenza. with the understanding that there is variation in that decrease in risk by year and by the medical status of the person receiving the vaccine and by the match between the strain and the circulating strain. Surrounding yourself with people who don't have influenza decreases your risk of getting influenza. Because this is passed person to person, if no one around you has influenza, your likelihood of getting influenza is also lower, and hospitalized patients would also prefer to be surrounded by caregivers who do not have influenza infection. Therefore, vaccinating healthcare personnel, as many as possible, is good for patients. So that's kind of the logic rationale. And now I'll bring up some of the data points that exist and the limitations that go along with that data. So there are data that show that influenza transmission does occur in healthcare settings. So there have been multiple descriptions of nosocomial influenza outbreaks. This is one study that reviewed 12 separate nosocomial acute care influenza outbreaks from the 1960s into the 2000s. And you can see attack rates can be pretty substantial among patients and also among healthcare personnel who provided care for patients with influenza. So without a big chicken and egg question about who had influenza first, there is influenza transmission going on between patients and healthcare personnel in these outbreaks. And in some of these outbreaks, though not in all, there was substantial attributable mortality related to those influenza infections. It is very difficult and has been very challenging to get really good data directly tying an individual infected healthcare worker to an individual infected patient and to prove that vaccination of that individual healthcare worker this year with this strain would have in fact prevented that infection in that patient. So within those limits, here's some of the data that exists. This is the this is a study from France in 2011 that did prospective surveillance of patients and healthcare workers for influenza-like illness. They did some testing, and certainly only about a quarter of the people who had an influenza-like illness had influenza, because there are many influenza-like illnesses and other viral respiratory pathogens circulating every year. And what they looked at was the risk of a patient acquiring an influenza-like illness depending on their exposure to either a healthcare worker with an influenza-like illness or a patient with an influenza-like illness or both. And what they found is that if a patient was exposed to a healthcare worker who had an influenza-like illness, the patient's risk of getting an influenza-like illness was increased fivefold. And if they were exposed to another patient, then their risk was increased 18-fold. And if they were exposed to both, then their risk was increased 35-fold. So substantial increase in risk depending on who they were exposed to is not particularly surprising, as we know how these diseases are transmitted. Again, not all of these illnesses are influenza. There are many other respiratory pathogens out there. Unfortunately, we don't have vaccines for them. This is another study that is frequently cited in this conversation. This study looked at rates of healthcare worker influenza vaccination in a single healthcare center and looked at the proportion of influenza cases in their hospital that were acquired in the hospital over that time period. And you can see there's clearly a divergence with an increasing rate of healthcare worker influenza vaccination. There were decreasing rate of nosocomial influenza acquisition. The limitations of this data are also clear from the graph. There's a lot of variability in the proportion of infections that were nosocomially acquired. Influenza varies by year and how severe the season is. The match with the vaccine also varies by year. So there's not a one-to-one correlation. It's not a direct perfect line. Also, you can note that, in fact, the rate of nosocomial influenza was fairly low, starting from a time when the influenza vaccination rate was not anywhere near 100%, and that it stayed low in a year when the vaccination rate approached 70%, so not at the level that we're aiming for with the 90 to 100% recommendation. So because this data is difficult to acquire in a real life setting, recently a couple of researchers in the Netherlands attempted mathematical modeling instead. So they developed a very complex mathematical model that I cannot explain to you that had many, many variables that affect the risk of hospital-acquired influenza, including visitors and length of stay, contact with healthcare personnel, time of contact, number of rooms that the patient might have been in, contact with other patients, And they varied all of those variables to see what the impact would be on the theoretical modeled risk of patients acquiring influenza in the hospital. And they found in that model that by vaccinating 100% of healthcare personnel, the risk to patients was reduced by about 43%. And they also found that there was no threshold level at which vaccinating more healthcare personnel did not result in decreasing risk to patients. So they saw benefit even in going from 98 to 99% vaccination rates, and 99 to 100% vaccination rates did have an immeasurable decrease in risk to the patient. Now, you can, and the limitations from this type of study, it's a model, so it's not real life. You can definitely take issue with the ways that they defined many of the different variables that are included, and some of the assumptions in terms of how many healthcare workers they assumed would get ill in a given year were fairly high. The overall risk to patients was fairly low, though it was decreased by vaccination. So those are some of the limitations that go into this interpretation. And then these studies are the ones that are referred to the most frequently and were also referred to by the previous speaker. These are all from long-term care settings, so again, not from acute care settings. And they have some variability as well in the way these were performed. But overall, what they found was that long-term care facilities with higher vaccination rates among healthcare personnel had lower rates of all-cause mortality among patients. So it's very difficult, again, to draw a straight line between vaccinating healthcare personnel against influenza and decreases in all-cause mortality. There's no particular reason that vaccinating me against the flu should prevent Tammy from having a heart attack. But nonetheless, the data was fairly consistent across these multiple centers on several different studies. So again, data that is suggestive, though definitely has some limitations. Those are the main data points that I think are cited the most often in this conversation, and hopefully I've been able to highlight some of the limitations of those data. Again, I think that that data doesn't necessarily change the logic proposition laid out in the first slide, but does show the limits of what we can actually prove in a data-driven argument. So to share with you a little bit of the discussion that has been going on in the vaccination subgroup, we do have some clear points of agreement. We all agree that vaccination is and should be and needs to remain only one part of a comprehensive influenza control and management plan. We all agree that healthcare personnel should get vaccinated every year. We agree that vaccination rates should be higher. We don't all agree on exactly how high and on what we should do to get them higher. And we all agree that it would be great to have a better vaccine with a more reliable efficacy, and preferably one that we didn't have to give every year. When we talked about methods to improve vaccination rates, we all agree on the importance of making this a priority and on the importance of providing adequate staff and resources, as the previous speakers have mentioned, to make this kind of program possible. We agree that that includes making the vaccine available easily to staff so that it's not something that access is a barrier for, and that part of that includes providing the vaccine free of charge to the employee. We agreed that the targeted education was also very important, including education around vaccine use and the myths around vaccine complications. And that we agreed on the importance of compliance and feedback. And then we got into discussions about what to do if all of those things do not result in a high enough rate. There is some data around the impact of these different strategies as well. This is a study that summarized other studies looking at different interventions to improve vaccination. You can see that education and promotion and mobile carts did all show an increase in vaccination rates, though the post-intervention rates were still fairly low. Declination statements have been more recently brought in as a successful intervention and have shown some success, though there's variability in the literature. But again, post-vaccination rates have not been at the 90% rate. The mandatory programs have been more successful in increasing rates and in achieving post-intervention rates closer to 99 and 98%. And Virginia Mason and BJC Healthcare are two settings that have published their results there and have shown sustained success. In discussions of mandatory vaccination, really the devil is in the details in terms of getting agreement from large groups of people. So what should actually be mandatory and what kind of exemption should be allowed, what kind of consequences of non-compliance should be considered, and whether these programs should be limited to high-risk clinical areas, and if so, what would we define as a low-risk clinical area, especially in acute care hospitals. I think that's very challenging. In general, people in favor of vaccines cite the fact that it works, vaccination rates are high, they turn to the ethical and professional imperative for healthcare personnel to do no harm, cite the safety of the vaccine, and the protection it provides for healthcare personnel and potentially for patients, and cite that there are other conditions for employment that exist already. Those opposed point to the coercive nature of these policies and the fact that they override healthcare personnel autonomy, believe that the data are lacking to support the benefit to patients and the lacking to set a herd immunity protective level to really tie consequences to a high level of vaccination like 90% or 100%. They anticipate legal and union challenges. They feel that a lot of eggs in this basket may limit participation with other program components and may provide a false sense of security as people feel that they are protected even in years that there may not be a good strain match. So with all of that, we did put together very preliminary draft recommendations. I need to stress over and over, these are not final. These are not going to anyone. These are still under discussion by the group. Pretty much most of us could agree on the four that are shown on this page, 1, 2, 3, and 5. Comprehensive programs need to be well supported. We should measure and report these, and it would be great to have a better vaccine. And currently, the role of employer requirements is stated like this, and again, this is also still under discussion. But for facilities who cannot reach the 90% goal despite implementation of recommendations 1 through 3, people should strongly consider a policy of employer requirement for influenza immunization. Factors to include in that kind of policy, factors to consider in that kind of policy include the acceptable reasons for exemption and consequences of noncompliance. And as stated now, the recommendations do not weigh in on what should be acceptable reasons for exemption or what should be consequences of noncompliance, but leave those up to the employer or up to the healthcare organization to decide in the development of their policy. So in summary, we have had many spirited discussions over the last year on this work group, and the discussions are still ongoing in efforts to finalize these recommendations. Once they are finalized, they will go for public comment, which those comments will be incorporated, and then we will present final recommendations to NVAC in February of 2012. So I'll also stop there, and we'll take questions at the end.